Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is no one whose intelligence I appreciate more on matters involving particularly what might be called the culture wars or political warfare facets of that war for the free world than our first guest. She is Diana West. We have the privilege of visiting with her each week from her perch at dianawest.net, her superb blog, as well as The Daily Caller, her two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
So, Diana, I want to talk about democratic socialism. Other names for it, I guess, have been progressivism, leftism, communism even. We have at the moment, of course, this rising star, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who explicitly announces her, role in and association with the democratic socialists. So help us calibrate who these folks are, and what they stand for, and what their agenda is for America.
Well, they stand for the destruction of individual liberty and individualism, even in and of itself. There is no free agency under the thumb of these people, whether they call themselves democratic socialists, socialists, progressives, Alinskyite. You forgot Alinskyite, which was the vogue term a few years ago. But all of these ideologies, these schools of thought, all emanate from Marx. From Marxist thinking, and these different variations, these different names are frankly, I believe, set out to confuse us as to the real roots. But it is about a cabal, a commissariat, a collective of people who determine how life shall be led by the masses. And everyone becomes a masses. No one's a citizen. We all become subjects. And that's essentially how we lose, how we lose our liberty is by following these people's guidance.
Yeah. Now, you describe something that is not well understood, and that is the size of this sort of body in the Congress, this subset of the Democratic Caucus that goes under the banner of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. There are quite a number of them that are Democratic Socialists out and out, but they call themselves progressives. Give us a sense of the size of that group in the House of Representatives in particular.
Yes, well, it is the largest caucus of Democrats within the Democratic Caucus in the Congress. So it has one senator, Bernie Sanders, and it has 78 House members. So there's no larger grouping of Democrats at the national level. And what I was very struck by with the sensationalism around Ms. Ocasio-Cortez was this notion being hammered home that she represents something new, that she is some kind of outlier, that she represents something different, assuming that she wins, coming to Washington in November. And what I did was I actually compared her agenda with that of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which very handily put out, they do every year, something that they call the People's Budget. And you can find very little daylight, if any at all, between her agenda and this already elected House Democratic and Bernie Sanders agenda. And I would add that the man she defeated, the old bull, Representative Patrick Crowley, whom she defeated in the primary upset, you can't find a whole lot of daylight between him and her either. The big difference, of course, being demographic, racial, ethnic, etc. And you know, that is really what we're talking about here. But they're all demagogues on this ideology.
This brings to the fore, of course, the man who is the chairman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, one Keith Ellison, who is also, lest we forget, the number two man in the Democratic National Committee. He has announced he's not going to run for re-election. Instead, he's going to hive off to run for the role of Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, from whence he hails. Give us just a sense of him. We have a new book coming out on Keith Ellison shortly by Trevor Loudon, who's done a lot of research on this and others of the Social Democrats, Communists, whatever you want to call them, in the Progressive Caucus of the House. But your take on him, Dinah West.
Again, if we look at him as holding two hats, we have the sort of the Muslim Brotherhood hat, and then we have the Marxist hat, which he demonstrates he manifests in everything he does. Very recently, something that did not garner many headlines, he gave an interview not too long ago. I think it was near the birthday of Karl Marx, the 200th birthday earlier this spring, sometime in that time vicinity. And he actually talked about how the idea was that the minimum wage was not enough. We needed a maximum wage. So, I mean, you are looking at the control of the economy by the government, which, again, is not only something that predominates among most elected Democrats in the Congress. This goes back to the New Deal. This was the essence of Franklin Roosevelt's, what I like to think of as the Second American Revolution in the 1930s, whereby the economic liberty in this country was taken, seized, assumed by the federal government. And this really is the font of this in terms of how the American socialist nation arose and took shape. And so we are looking at a continuum. You and I always talk about this being a continuum, but it really is. And the idea that Ocasio-Cortez represents something we've never seen before is laughable, but it again shows how little pundits and reporters and other commentators actually know about our history and about our economic history.
Well, and more to the point, that how little they're doing to illuminate all of that for the rest of us. And to what extent, Dinah West, in your judgment, does that reflect a solidarity on the part of most in journalism these days with the progressives, social democrats at all?
Yes, absolutely. They work hand in glove together. I thought it was very interesting to note that some of the party elders, you might say, coming out of, say, the Clinton days, I'm thinking, actually were very quick to caution that the party does need white people. It does need white men in particular, going back to that primary race between Patrick Clowerley and Ocasio-Cortez, and cautioning that they will not actually win on a demographic kind of appeal to socialism among Latinos and so on. I mean, this was kind of where the Ocasio-Cortez story was going. So they are very cognizant that this is very avant-garde, if you will, and may actually backfire on them in November, which is, of course, what we will hope. And I actually do feel fairly good about that notion that this really unmasks the Democrats in a way that they perhaps are not able or ready to deal with. Now, the flip side of that would be that actually we have been socialized to a point where it doesn't matter anymore. We are so accustomed to being a democratic socialist nation that we will just follow along, and it will not arouse that kind of voter indignation and upset, but we'll see.
Well, it behooves the Republicans, it seems to me, to offer a choice, a clear alternative. Dinah, thank you so much for your insights in all of this. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Philip Haney, a former member of the Department of Homeland Security, about the importance of ICE and the risks associated with its abolishment. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we're joined by one of my personal heroes, Philip Haney. He is a retired member of the Department of Homeland Security, indeed a founding member, a plank holder, as they call it, in that department. He served as an armed customs and border protection officer. He has been widely recognized, indeed given rather important citations by the Department of Homeland Security over the years for his expertise in matters involving Sharia supremacism, the term I prefer. Islamic theology is another of his attributes, but also the tactics of the global jihad movement. He has drawn on all of these experiences, including several tours of duty at the National Targeting Center in Washington, D.C., for an important book, a bestseller by him and Art Moore, entitled See Something, Say Nothing. A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. Philip Haney, it's so good to have you back. Thank you so much for your service to our country and that you're rendering these days in your post-government career.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, friend.
Well, I'm anxious to get your thoughts, Phil, as a man who has been present from the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and with it the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization, which has come in for an enormous amount of criticism of late. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts about the importance of ICE, as it's best known, and the implications of abolishing it. And drawing on your own hard experience at DHS, Phil, when you came in for a lot of criticism for doing your job, again, chronicled in your book, See Something, Say Nothing, what the implications are for the morale of a team of people we desperately need to be protecting us from enemies foreign and, in this case, domestic at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization?
Well, thank you very much for asking that. I'm sure all the law enforcement officers, even the ones that are not in ICE or CBP or Border Patrol, will appreciate your asking that question. Basically, the entire time that I was in the agency, the morale of either ICE, CBP, or Border Patrol was consistently the lowest of all federal agencies. And yet, I don't think it would be hard to make the case that we have the most important job, that's national security, securing our border. And the reason why the morale was so low is because we can never keep up with the policies and that were coming down from the leaders of our agencies through the executive branch of the government to allow us to do our job. And so we were basically handcuffed and blindfolded, thus the famous or infamous catch and release program as one example. So is there hope for improvement? Absolutely. There's a lot of people that are active duty who are just waiting for the day when they're released to do the job. And I'm not talking about violating civil rights and civil liberties. I'm simply speaking about enforcing the law, helping protect the border, and secure our national security.
And Phil Haney, what is it that is impeding them from doing that now? There's a lot of talk on the part of the left that it's, if anything, doing too much of that sort of thing. Talk a little bit about, again, what are we expecting of the people at ICE, and why aren't they able to do their job currently, as you see it?
Well, there's a good example. ICE has been criticized from one extreme to the other. First, they were criticized for early release in the multiple tens of thousands, and then they were criticized lately for enforcing immigration law and attempting to apprehend and deport the people that are here illegally. So how is a law enforcement officer supposed to do his job when he's criticized either for not doing enough or doing too much? And that's why morale is so low.
Very quickly, in your professional judgment, Philip Haney, if we were to abolish ICE, is the president right that we would almost certainly see a much more dangerous United States?
We have already. That refers back to the early release program that was instituted in the last administration. A huge outbreak of crime related to the illegal immigrants that were here. So the answer is obvious. Yes, we would.
Okay. Let me switch gears, Phil. I mentioned that you were one of the country's preeminent experts on, particularly in the law enforcement space, the threat of the global jihad movement or global Islamic movement. I think of it as Sharia supremacism. In America, there is a report that a bomb plot was intercepted in Cleveland, scheduled to cause casualties on the 4th of July. Phil, give us your professional assessment of where we are with respect to the problem of, again, for want of a better term, Sharia supremacism in the United States at the moment.
Well, the indicator, that's the term that I use, trends, also called the dots, we heard about so much.
Connect those dots.
Yes. Well, there's a literal dot on the very forehead of the individual who has been apprehended, which means he's a what I call a dedicated individual, which means he attends a mosque, and that means he prays five times a day, carefully. So that means what? That he's affiliated with other individuals. He's not an isolated person who's just floating around in the social environment. No, he's connected with a group of people.
Let me ask you about that, Phil, because we're always told when these kinds of incidents occur that they're lone wolves. There's no obvious connection to any other group or, sort of impetus. They may have trained on the internet or something. But you're suggesting that if they're associated with a mosque, not just any old mosque, but a Sharia supremacist mosque, I assume, that there's a high likelihood that that individual has, in fact, been incubating on this Sharia supremacism with others of a like mind. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, my point is that there's an absolute certainty he's affiliated with a mosque and a community, a group of people. I don't need to, surmise what it is, what group right now exactly, but the point is even Sharia law authorizes individuals to address what is called fitna or opposition to the advancement of Sharia law. He's not operating alone. And that's the part that bothers me the most when we hear the stories, is that they never seem to take the next step and make the association between the individual and whatever organization, including a mosque, that he might be involved with. That's what got me so much in trouble when I was active duty, is making those associations.
Yeah, connecting those dots.
Yes, connecting the dots. And it's an absolute certainty just based on, as I mentioned earlier, the indicator, the actual portion on his forehead that shows that he prays regularly five times a day. Well, where does he pray? Not by himself, because Muslims don't pray like that by themselves. They're part of a community. So what's the question? What community is he a part of? Well, yeah, we should find that out.
And what were they promoting in its midst? Phil, and of course, you're talking about the bruise, I guess it is, that is a sort of permanent mark on the forehead of those who bang their head on the ground repeatedly in this fashion. A sign of, devotion, I think something that is esteemed in this Sharia supremacist community. Phil, to what extent, I know from your time there inside the Department of Homeland Security, you were very much embroiled in this effort not to know much about all of this. Has what was called the Great Purge with respect to information about Sharia and the ambitions of those who seek to impose it upon all of us, the purge, the Great Purge, as it was called, of training about all of that, been reversed inside the agency in which you served?
Well, there's hope that it will be. Although with the narrative that we've seen with this recent case in Cleveland, there's still a lot of room for improvement. But I can say that I'm more optimistic, more hopeful than I have been since at least 2006. Because around 2006 is about where things started going really sideways.
Well, it's heartening, and I hope that you will be part of that reprogramming that is needed for our law enforcement and others in the first lines of defense of this country. We're talking with Phil Haney. He is the author of See Something, Say Nothing. And Phil, very quickly, if you had a word of advice, what would you recommend that American citizens do to try to help address the problems we're discussing here?
I always go to the Constitution. I like to cite the Constitution as the definition of our sovereignty. I would encourage people to read Article 1 of the Constitution, which says that the federal government's primary responsibility is to have a uniform naturalization law and to secure our borders, and or look at Amendment 14, which talks about that laws should be applied equally to everybody in the country. And this big push towards sanctuary cities is unconstitutional. So become familiar with what's going on in your own neighborhood. A lot of primaries going on around the country. Get involved.
Amen. Phil Haney, thank you for being involved, my friend. It's great to have you with us, as always. Congratulations again on the memoirs that you've written for all of us to learn from your experience in the government. See Something, Say Nothing. Check it out, folks. Phil, come back to us very soon. In the meantime, you're one great American. Have a great American 4th of July. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, Dr. Harold Rowe joins us. We'll visit with him about the developments in Turkey, Iran, and Israel of concern, and more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined now, I'm pleased to say, by one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving the Middle East. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He was for many years really the preeminent authority in the Defense Department on countries like Iran and Iraq and Turkey. And he served with great distinction in the Office of Net Assessment under Dr. Andrew Marshall. He has really been an extraordinary resource to me personally, and I think to many in government over the years. I'm happy to say these days he's serving as a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, a marvelous organization that is chronicling, as few others are, important developments in the world today, especially as they relate to the security of the United States. Harold Rode is, among other things, an author. He has, in recent months, been involved with the production of an important book for the Center for Security Policy entitled Turkey, Ally No More. He's one of its important contributors. He is also the author of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Rode, welcome back. So good to have you, sir.
Nice to hear your voice, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So, Harold, let me start with the issue of your recent essay in Turkey, Islam, Ally No More. We have had reason to be very concerned about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, the former prime minister of Turkey. Now, those concerns have been greatly intensified, it seems to me, by his recent election victory and the kinds of government that he will now be in a position to operate. Talk to us a little bit about the election and what its implications are for both the Turks, for NATO, and for us.
Well, it's an Islamist victory, and who knows whether they were free and fair. Who knows who's allowed to vote in Turkey? Because a lot of the Syrian refugees, Sunni Syrian refugees, have also been allowed to vote. We don't know how many, and they no doubt voted for Erdogan because that's how they got Turkish citizenship to do this. Now, I mean, it's a malleable commodity in the Middle East, citizenship. It's easy to get, and it's easy to lose. Anyway, he now has concentrated so much power in his hands. It's been a slow process. Slowly but surely, he has neutered all sorts of groups that could oppose him, whether it's the taking over the newspapers, or the military, all these groups. It doesn't matter. It's all of them. Now, Turkey is no longer in any way a democracy. And the result, I mean, he's the dictator. He makes all the decisions. What he says will be implications for NATO. Do we really want dictatorships in NATO? Isn't NATO based on sort of freedom and democracy? Do we want Islamist nations in NATO? There's no doubt that there are many people who oppose Erdogan in Turkey, but he has basically neutralized them. He has checkmated them, it seems. And it doesn't look good either for the West, for Turkey, and for those Turks who believe in freedom and democracy and secularism. So, look, we'll see. I don't know what else to say. That's the bottom line.
We will see, indeed. In the meantime, Harold, do you consider it advisable for the United States to be transferring the F-35 frontline fighter in substantial numbers to the Turks?
In not only substantial, any numbers. Why do we want to help an enemy? They're helping the fundamentalists all over the place. Erdogan's goal is simply to re-Islamify first the entire Ottoman Empire, which is the Arab world, Southeast Europe, and Anatolia of today, and then go on and take over basically slowly but truly, set in process the idea of taking over the entire world. I know that sounds fanciful, but people don't think like Erdogan doesn't think like we do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and unfortunately, the fanciful ideas, as we may see them, are nonetheless the plans of our enemies. And in this case, I think that's what we're dealing with. Harold, let's ask you quickly. There was a very important and quite alarming article that recently appeared, I believe, in the Jerusalem Post, talking about the involvement of the Turks now in Jerusalem, in what seems to be a setup to, I don't know, perhaps the occupation of the Temple Mount by so-called Turkish tourists or other forms of subversion of Jewish control of Jerusalem. You've spent a lot of time in Israel. Are you seeing signs of this? And should we, and most especially the Israelis, be concerned about what the Turks are up to there?
Oh, absolutely we should be concerned. First of all, there are all these tourist groups are coming from Turkey to ostensibly for religious pilgrimage. That's fine. There's only one problem. They go, and their goal is to take over everything. Now, the real victims, believe it or not, it's not going to be Israel or the Jews. It's going to be the Arabs who don't like them. They're trying to take over. That is Erdogan. He's the one who's pushing this. To take over all the Muslim sites, and in his war to, again, be sultan or to create a sultan empire again, Jerusalem for them now has become a very important issue. Now, the Israelis are onto this. And when they expelled the Israeli ambassador in Turkey, when the Turks expelled them, the Israelis responded by a few things. Among other things, there is a Turkish consulate in Jerusalem, which has been giving money to all sorts of Islamist, viciously anti-Semitic and anti-Western groups in Jerusalem. And the result now is that the Israelis are onto this, and all these organizations that were set up, Islamic organizations, slowly but surely, the money is drying up.
Yeah. Did they close the consulate in Jerusalem?
They didn't close the consulate, but they sent the consul home. That is, they expelled him.
Well, it may be that more draconian steps are in order here. We'll be following it closely, as I know will you, Harold. Listen, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about one other thing, Harold. There have clearly been some very momentous developments in Iran, another country in which you've spent a lot of time and about which you're extremely knowledgeable. I wanted to ask you both about what is going on as you see it on the ground there at the moment, and also to comment, Harold Rode, if you would, on this event that was held last week in Paris, hosted by something called the Mujahideen al-Khalq, M-E-K, or the National Council for the Resistance in Iran. I'd like to know who you think these folks are and whether they actually are an opposition that we should be supporting to the current regime in Iran and help possibly, rise to power there.
Well, to the first part of your question in the beginning, there's no doubt that we are seeing wonderful things happening in Iran. And they are, and we're seeing signs that the regime doesn't know what to do. There was a fanciful article this morning that the regime says that the reason we're having a drought throughout Iran is because the Israelis are stealing our clouds. Now, that's pretty good, I have to steal someone else's clouds. Now, what it really shows is that the government doesn't know what to say or what to do. And the more they show weakness, the more the people are going to speak out. And our job should be to encourage them, to help them in all sorts of quiet ways. And we hopefully will see in the not too distant future the people taking over their country, taking their country back. Now, what's going to happen afterwards? All we care about is that they're prepared to get along with the Western world and to not to make trouble in the Middle East. That would be fine. We would like an old Iranian ally that we had before, like under the Shah. Now, as to your question about the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK, they're a very interesting organization. We should sometimes, there are two views on this. I personally, they're a bunch of Islamic Marxists. They are no friends of the United States. There's no doubt. That is, as far as I'm concerned, that's my view. Having said that, there's another view, and I think it's worth talking about. I know people who have viciously hate these people, who have said we should be working with anybody with any connections inside the country at the moment to help overthrow this regime. That organization does have interesting context, but we have to realize that once things are over, that is, once this regime falls, in no way should we be supporting these people. They hate the West. I remember them, listen, from the revolution before, walking down the streets here in Washington after I had come back from Iran, and they were strongly opposed to Khomeini. We were strongly opposed to Khomeini. So we have a common, I told them, and I told them in Persian, in their language. I said, look, we all hate Khomeini, but you guys basically want to set up something which could end up being much worse than Khomeini.
I'm told, Harold, that that one of the considerations for many in Iran about the MEK or NCRI is that they were aligned with Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War and were responsible for killing large numbers of their countrymen, nominally. This is not likely to end well if we're behind them. And I must say I regret that people I generally admire, like Rudy Giuliani and Newt Gingrich, were in their company last weekend. Harold Rode, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk about, but we're going to have to do it on another occasion. We appreciate your visits tremendously, as well as your cumulative expertise and experience in the Defense Department and now with the Gatestone Institute. I know I don't need to tell you to keep it up. You will, of course, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, Kevin Freeman will join us. We'll talk with him about Iran's efforts to get money from Europe and more.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm very pleased to say welcome back, and especially welcome to Kevin Freeman, a man I have come to admire greatly for his acumen about particularly economic warfare, the implications for our security of people seeking to use what he calls the battle space of business for essentially military and strategic purposes to our great detriment. Kevin is, of course, the author of two important books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is the driving force behind a new television program entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and he blogs at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Always welcome here, Kevin Freeman. Good to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
So I was just talking with Harold Rode in the previous segment about what's going on with Iran. It seems as though they're in pretty desperate straits. And perhaps for that reason, the president, Rouhani, who of course is not really in charge, but nonetheless the titular head of the government, is panhandling, I guess it's fair to say, in Europe at the moment, hoping against hope that the Europeans will bail the Iranians out, despite economic sanctions the United States is imposing after the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was decoupled by President Trump. Tell us what you think is going on there, Kevin, and what we should be doing vis-a-vis the Europeans in this regard.
Any nation that is coming under Trump's watch or concern is looking to garner international support against him and thus in their favor. And of course, the Iranians are doing that as well. But I think that they're going to run into some problems, namely that the Gulf states led by Saudi Arabia are more important to Europe than Iran is. And the Gulf states are going to likely use the leverage that they have to cut off the Iranians.
There seems to be some evidence that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, has already been doing that, particularly vis-a-vis the Germans. Between those and the secondary sanctions that the United States has imposed, it doesn't look as though the Europeans have a lot of running room on this, Kevin. Is that fair, or am I missing something?
Well, that certainly is the hope, because the Iranian regime has been a state sponsor of terror, and if Riyadh and the United States and others stand up to them, then that would be the good news, that the Europeans won't have much place to go and that they will not be able to prop up what looks like it's a failing regime.
Yeah, a failing regime, and one that is threatening them, too, let's be clear. Those medium-range missiles that the Iranians have begun developing and deploying are aimed at Europe. I think there's no getting around that, so they better get with the program. Kevin, let me turn to a related topic. We have, of course, had President Trump imposing sanctions of a different kind, tariffs, on Europe and on China, of course. There are some who are arguing that this is precipitating a trade war, a tariff war. There is also some concern that we may simply, by virtue of applying these tariffs rather comprehensively to friends and foes alike, perhaps driving former into the latter's arms. What are your thoughts on where things stand right now and how the hand is being played by President Trump?
Well, there certainly would be a concern if we lost allies over this, but President Trump is focused initially on China. China is the problem. It's a threat. And I saw Art Cashin on CNBC the other day. Art Cashin is the well-known trader. He's been around for decades. He's highly respected. And his observation was pretty simple. It was President Trump has applied tariffs to China, and they look for products to apply tariffs back. They just don't buy much from us. And so to that degree, the Chinese are realizing how lopsided the trade arrangement has been. They just don't have much weapon to fight back with. And so, you know, to that degree, I believe President Trump's trade approach is actually being effective against China. And I think the rest of the world has unfairly taken advantage of America as well. And you know, it's time for a reset in trade.
You have, however, written a cautionary tale, Kevin, in your blog, I believe, about who might be willing to cause a market crash, which has kind of as its subtext, perhaps this is one of the other instruments that a China, for example, might be willing to wield, given that they don't have a lot of, well, leverage, shall we say, with respect to tariffs on American imports. Talk a little bit about that possibility, and more broadly, Kevin, your assessment of who else might be interested in precipitating a crisis in the U.S. capital markets.
Well, there was an interesting article in Asia Times, and your guest, David Goldman, I listened to him on your program, mentioned this particular article where a Chinese official said that they might raise a financial war with the United States. And when he was using that, he was using language that came from the book Unrestricted Warfare in 1999, in which they described financial warfare in which a country is subjugated without a drop of blood being spilled means entering and subverting banking and stock markets and manipulating the value of a targeted currency. Well, if the Chinese are raising the specter of financial war and retaliation, we have to look at the stock market, for example, as one area that they might attempt to crash. And they have multiple ways to do this, whether it would be through hacking or through manipulation of their currency, which they're lowering their currency now, or through any of a number of other ways that they have planned. And the Russians have planned as well. And so it occurs to me that if you want to change the elections in the United States, the highest correlation between the party in power retaining power or losing power is whether the stock market remains stable or rising, or if it crashes. And if it crashes, the party in power almost always loses power. And we see an upcoming midterm, so it seems likely that this threat of financial war could include an attack on the stock market. And there are people on the left in the United States that are actually cheering, looking forward to it, whether it's George Soros or Bill Maher.
Kevin, speaking of Soros, I did want you just to drill down for a minute on some of the activities that he's engaged in over the years to destroy various nations' economies. And whether you think it would be in his interest to do such a thing to ours in this election cycle in particular.
George Soros is most famous as the man who broke the Bank of England in the early 1990s. He literally shorted the British pound and caused it such turmoil in England that it actually probably kept them out of the European Union early on. And so maybe they should thank him for it. They're not a part of the euro. As a result, they maintained their separate currency. But nevertheless, he was using international weapons in the early 90s that broke a major nation's currency. He's been involved in stock markets around the world, the Malaysian stock market, for example. The Malaysian prime minister called him a financial terrorist because he literally hurt the economy in Malaysia and other nations around the world. And if he applied that same kind of weapon here to manipulate the election, he would get what he wanted, and I think he'd be willing to do it if it broke President Trump.
Kevin Freeman, before I let you go, we've been hearing a lot of late about how the North Koreans are continuing to behave in a manner very inconsistent with some of their commitments to President Trump at the recent summit between Kim Jong-un and him in Singapore. Would it surprise you if the North Koreans were also continuing to beaver away at things like cyber warfare, which they have used against American companies and interests already in the past?
Well, let me put it the opposite. It would shock me if they had given up any cyber weapons. They can achieve many of the goals that they have, terror threats, theft, through cyber means. And so they will continue to hack. They have been hacking, continue to hack, and they've not been held accountable for any of it. And yet they have one of the most elite cyber warfare elements in the world. And so I would be shocked if they stopped. They've likely continued, and they will continue to extract, they'll hack people and they'll hold them for ransom. So they'll continue to extract money and use these to threaten the nations of the world.
And you have written about in your book, Game Plan, the distinct threat of attacks on our electric grid. And I assume you were in agreement with other experts we've talked to that the North Koreans may well have the ability to use cyber warfare, perhaps electromagnetic pulse and other means as well, but certainly cyber warfare against the electric grid with devastating effects.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that the grid is vulnerable, and there's no doubt that they have the capability. The question is when and how they would use it.
Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today. I wish you the very best for the 4th of July. Your patriotism and service to our country in so many ways is really appreciated, including, as by the way, a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep up the great work you do at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman and globaleconomicwarfare.com. And we'll look forward to resuming this conversation with you next week, Kevin. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.